You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
To the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm continuing my long series of shows on the interesting notion of progress. So we've been looking at lots of different ideas with regarding progress, and now that we've gotten to Enlightenment ideas, we're starting to deal with this ideas of specific thinkers. So last week, we ended our discussion on the ideas of David Hume, and then we had a kind of case example of progress in the city of Vancouver and policy questions around Stanley Park. To jump into something new, now we are talking about Adam Smith. So you might wonder, what does Adam Smith have to do with progress? Adam Smith is often regarded as an economist, but in fact he began his career as a philosopher. His first work, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, addressed the philosophy of moral judgment and action, and is therefore not surprising that The Wealth of Nations, the work on economic growth for which he is best known, has a deeper philosophical resonance. It's worth noting that Adam Smith is often called the grandfather of economics, because at this point, economics hadn't really been created as a field. It was still being in the act of being created, and he was kind of one of the founders of the ideas which kind of triggered the creation of the field of economics. Although it's worth noting that Smith based his work off of works in France that were happening during this Enlightenment period as well, so not everything he wrote was absolutely unique to him. Although he did also have some unique ideas. Smith's central observation, going back to the text, is that in economic life, it often happens that individuals, in pursuit of their self-interest, nevertheless contribute to the common good. It is as though they are led by an invisible hand to take socially beneficial actions. For instance, Smith argues that the division of labor is the spontaneous outcome of the human propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. Humans engage in this activity for self-interested reasons, but the growth in productivity of labor in a society is largely due to a greater division of labor. It is because of a greater division of labor, Smith contends, that the poorest members of European countries are richer than the richest members of societies in other parts of the world. We now encounter something very interesting, which is the idea of, can societies be propelled towards progress without anyone intending to create progress? So if you essentially set the right rules of the game, will progress happen spontaneously? It's actually a very interesting question if human progress is something that human beings choose to create, or it's just something that kind of happens to human beings and it's an entirely natural process.
It sounds to me like one of the premises of capitalism.
Certainly. That, Smith is also known as being one of the founders of capitalist thought.
Sure. And that's probably the central premise of capitalism, or one of them anyway, that people in pursuit of their own interest will be bettering society, that there's synchronization there between, you know, common interest between people pursuing their own interest and the betterment of society. Whether that's true or not is obviously has been debated and will be debated.
So just to dig into that a little bit more, I don't have a really deep understanding of Smith, but from what I've read, because I was actually very curious about this earlier in my time in university, although I didn't take classes and I did some reading up on it. And Smith actually defines capitalist in a very negative sense, and you might, and our audience might find that interesting. So a capitalist, according to him, is someone who essentially is out for their own self-interest above and everything else, and essentially is willing to do what it takes to perpetuate their self-interest in society. And he didn't actually see that as a positive thing. But from his perspective, it seems more that like, okay, there are going to be these types of people in society. I guess he saw them as highly motivated individuals. And so the question was then, well, how can we get these types of individuals to serve society rather than be a detriment to society? So in Smith's time, this economic system that was prevalent was called mercantilism, which essentially worked something along the lines of, if you wanted to control a certain industry or work in a certain industry, you needed to get express permission from the monarchy. Many of the people who were very rich or who controlled corporations had essentially royal monopolies on the distribution of certain goods and services. So what Smith was arguing for in his time was that we should let all individuals kind of have a free market rather than and buy and sell goods and services independent of monarchical permission. Of course, that was a very different world from the world we live in now. It's interesting to think about that when you take away the privilege of one set of individuals who have essentially permission from a central government to only distribute a certain set of goods, when you open that up to anyone who is willing or able to do that, you have more options and a better change and flow of resources, which can be more efficient and better on the whole. Because one group of people, when they're chosen by a central government, they may not necessarily be the best people for the job. They might not necessarily, even if they are very good at the job, they might not have enough people, or they may not be able to coordinate people as effectively as, you say, three or four groups of individuals working as separate corporations in that field. That's kind of where we get the idea of division of labor. There are some critiques with this, but I certainly think that Smith's point about the division of labor and allowing greater freedom for individuals in society. So if you want to open a business or sell a product, being able to do that freely, independent of permission from a centralized authority in a monarchical institution, you had to get a royal warrant before you were allowed to sell something, and often royal warrants were exceedingly difficult to get. So by essentially cutting back red tape and allowing more everyday individuals of society to participate in trade and the creation of goods and services, you allow the nation to create more wealth for itself. So that was one of the ideas there.
There's a false dilemma in there. The false dilemma being that there are only two choices. One is that a monarch or some sort of dictatorial or authoritarian regime, government, would control the market and would give permission or not for individuals or groups of people to enter the market and produce certain products or services. And on the other hand, a free capitalist market. But that's a false dilemma because there are other possibilities. For example, one could imagine a world where permission is required to enter the marketplace as a producer, but the permission doesn't come from a monarch or an authoritarian or a dictator, but it comes from a democratically elected government with the apparatus in place, the agencies in place, the administrative agencies in place to make judgments about what products and services were necessary or should be allowed. So that's another option. And that comes to mind in the sense that, let me give you an example of what you're describing, Aaron, as division of labor might be characterized as duplication of labor. So I think about all of the junk mail that still comes to my physical mailbox, all the catalogs and advertisements and junk. These are the free market. These are companies, groups of people in the free market trying to promote their product. But it seems like we know enough now, as science has developed and our awareness of environmental degradation, sustainability, we know enough that it seems like it's a bad choice for society to have all these mass mailings, you know, to have the resources used to mail out stuff to people in the mail, the trees that get cut down, the pollution that gets generated, for individuals in the free market or groups in the free market to promote their product. How does it benefit society for us to be bombarded with paper and also bombarded with spam emails by people trying to promote their products and services in the free market? So one might say that there's a duplication of labor, duplication of effort, unnecessary promotion of an unnecessary number of products in the interest of people pursuing their individual interests. And that's not really good for society. And there should be more regulation, not from a monarch, but from some perhaps democratically elected government.
It is important to add that just like every political system, every economic system will have strengths and weaknesses. No human system is perfect. And historically speaking, the capitalistic system, which was, realistically speaking, was it really better for the average individual? Not so much. Because for the average individual to create a factory or something that was wealth producing was still something that wasn't, the average individual still wasn't really able to do that. But what it did allow for is it allowed for more competition, you could say, within among aristocrats, and it kind of changed the way that the competition between aristocrats happens. Whereas previously, kind of the competition happened between aristocrats before the monarch, now the competition was happening in kind of the marketplace of products. And that's kind of the idea of the invisible hand. Failure to see the work of the invisible hand will lead to unwise policies. Smith says that in the absence of government intervention, self-interest leads each nation to produce only the goods in which it has a comparative advantage. Self-interested behavior in the presence of a government, attempts to support domestic industries actually lead to in a worse outcome. One goal of the book is admittedly practical, to attack mercantilism, the doctrine that dominated economic policy in Europe from the 16th century onward. Mercantilism holds that aggressive government intervention is the key to increasing national wealth. Accordingly, during this time, the governments of Europe attempted to steer and promote domestic industries, most notably by placing high tariffs on foreign imports. Smith argues against these policies. He writes that tariffs on imports harm a nation as a whole by misdirecting its resources. In general, the government should play a circumscribed role in the economic life of a country, confining itself to the protection of property rights, the support of a national defense force, and the provision of a few other key public goods. Smith's emphasis on spontaneous improvement in economic life warrants treating him as a theorist of progress. But given his worries about mercantilism, it is clear that he thinks this type of development is fragile. Nations will not maximize their wealth unless they have the wisdom to allow spontaneous growth to occur. Smith intends the wealth of nations to help policymakers recognize the phenomenon that he believes to have correctly identified. Progress for a society, should it mean, and this kind of gets to back to the first question I was asking on the first show, is should it mean one specific thing? Should it be a unified, rigorous, well-defined concept, or should it be more a set of related concepts that we basically just see, we mainly just identify them from the past, because seeing them in the present, it's hard to identify what progress is and what isn't. So is it something that is concrete and defined, or is it something that can take many forms? Can we have technological progress, scientific progress, economic progress, political progress, or legal progress in terms of creating better justice in a society? If progress can take many forms, are all of these things equally progress, or are they just different manifestations of the same thing? So
the concept of progress can be value free or value laden. And that's sort of another way of restating, I think, what your question was, what you were asking there, Aaron. If it's value free, value neutral, maybe, seems like anyone should be able to accept it just on its face. And that would just be like progression from state A to state B to state C to state D, as opposed to remaining static. So that's a value neutral explanation or definition of progress, which is just progression from one state to the next state and on to the next state. But as soon as you start to make assertions that one type of change is progress and another type is not progress, now you're adding value judgment. And that's your value judgment, the person adding it, or maybe the value judgment of a particular culture or subculture or society, but it may not be the same value judgment as another group of people have about it. So for example, if you're going to define progress as a value-laden concept, is the relaxing of governmental intervention, removal of governmental intervention from the free marketplace, is that progress or is it going backwards? It certainly is movement, but is it the kind of movement that we would call in a value-laden definition that we'd call progress?
And it's important,
that depends on what your values are.
It's important to note here, the thinkers of the Scottish and French Enlightenment authors, they are empiricists. So within that strict, and we've had this discussion in the past on the show, that empiricists essentially are not ethicists by definition, because they try to see the world as it is, and they kind of shy away from trying to see the world as it ought to be. So Adam Smith was, for better or for worse, an empiricist. He was trying to see the world as he saw it was, not trying to see how it ought to be. So he was trying to see, well, you know, this is how the world is. There are such a thing as capitalists, and there are such a thing as moral sentiments. I have a theory about how they operate, and because they operate in this way, almost in terms of like a scientific law under certain conditions, then if we want to see economic growth, we have to respect the invisible hand, these ideas of spontaneous these ideas that will promote spontaneous economic growth in a society.
Right. But to my point, whether economic growth is progress or not is a value judgment. Because one can make the argument that economic growth, at least some types of economic growth, are not progress at all. Economic growth is accompanied oftentimes by environmental degradation, by depletion of natural resources, by abuse of workers and certain classes of people, and economic growth may benefit some people more than others. So to say that that's progress, I'm not commenting on whether it is or not. I mean, you might pick up that I'm skeptical, right? That's fine. But that's a value judgment. Someone might define progress as further restrictions on the free market, because that creates more equitability. It creates more possibility for protection of the environment by more governmental intervention. And that's what we need now. So progress now, according to some people, might be further an increased regulation of private enterprise to constrain some of the damage that it's doing to the environment, for example, or some of the duplication, unnecessary duplication of resource consumption and excessive marketing and excessive bombardment of information and advertising to common people. Maybe that's progress. So it's a value judgment to say that economic growth per se is progress.
Yeah, I think that is an accurate statement. And that kind of moves us to a question that I've been thinking about but haven't yet voiced on this show, is there such a thing as moral progress? Because that kind of gets to the point of, if some types of progress are immoral, are other types of progress moral? And that whether or not progress is something that fits with the is-ought distinction, makes the world closer to how we think the world should be in the future, that will be something that we will continue to see as we look at other thinkers, particularly in the next show on the 19th century.
So to conclusion, to continue reading just a little bit more, we're now moving on to Kant. So unlike them, the German Enlightenment figure, Immanuel Kant, reasons in an a priori manner to the conclusion that humanity is progressing. Kant's writing on progress consists of a series of short pieces from the 1780s to 1790s, including Ideas Toward a Universal History with Cosmopolitan Intent and Perpetual Peace. In addition to its reliance on a priori reasoning, Kant's work is noteworthy for its emphasis on world peace and its detailed description of the domestic and international institutions needed for peaceful conditions. So when I first read this, I found this very interesting, that the idea of world peace and international institutions goes all the way back to Kant and maybe before him, but at least that far. So I'll read a bit more and then we can discuss this. So Kant remarks that certain trends are compatible with progress, but cautions that no trajectory can be inferred with certainty from the facts. So he doesn't say that we can predict the future. His a priori argument begins with the premise that all animals have natural faculties. If nature is not to be in vain, we must assume that the faculties of an animal can be developed. Unlike other animals, the human being cannot develop all of its faculties in a lifetime. If the faculties given to humans are not to be considered useless, then the only other possibility is that the human race as a whole over time will develop all the human faculties. The progress from one era to another is measured by the development of human faculties during that time. Kant thinks that human faculties can reach their fullest expression only in a free and peaceful circumstances, which in turn require a particular set of institutions. A federation of republics will mark the final stage of human development. A republic is a state based on the rule of law whose members are free and equal citizens. A federation is a group of nations who have agreed to observe rules of peaceful conduct in their mutual relations. Kant argues that the domestic and international features of this institutional constellation will reinforce each other. Republics will not go to war with each other because a declaration of war requires the consent of the public, who are reluctant to pay a war's price. In turn, domestic conditions will be improved in the absence of a state's constant involvement in wars. The details of the development toward the peaceful federation are given by Kant's Universal History. This narrative is presented at best consistent with empirical evidence. Kant argues that for the most part, human psychology and the natural environment, rather than human reason, could have driven the human race forward. First, he attributes progress to the unsocial ability of human beings. Humans are social because they cannot develop their capabilities in isolation, yet they are unsocial because they want to get their own way. These characteristics lead them to form associations in which all vie for status. These associations are the seeds of republics. But progressive human activity need not be lacking in awareness. Kant maintains that a philosophy of progress can accelerate progress. All right, so that was a lot of ideas, but there were a lot of connections there, so I wanted to keep it together, and now we can go back over it a bit more piece by piece, I think.
What you just read was suggestive of why some people consider Kant to be a social contract theorist, which assertion surprised me, right? After I had learned about Kant and then separately learned about social contract theory. But you alluded in that reading just now to the fact that Kant talks about how people must form communities, right? Must form alliances in order to promote their growth as the potential, their human potential, the realization of their human potential. That sounds like a social contract, because he said in the absence of those alliances, people are pursuing their individual goals, but they can't do it individually. They can't do it on their own.
Could
so it's a form of a social contract.
Take a step back a bit kind of introduce the audience to the idea of social contract theory. I don't know if everyone would be familiar
sure.
with that.
Well, the quintessential social contract theorist was Hobbes, I guess, right? We talk about Hobbes. Everyone learns about Hobbes in probably their first philosophy class. Where's their second philosophy class? And, of course, Hobbes, just to abbreviate, his theory into a nutshell, he talks about a state of nature, the theoretical state of nature in which people would live without any social contract, without any agreements, without any political state, without any laws, without any rules. And in such a state, people would be out for themselves only. There'd be no morality. There'd be no reason for anyone to cooperate. They were just everyone was in a state of war with everyone else. The war of all against all. A miserable place to live, a dangerous place. No one would want to live there. So what they do is they form political states in order to create rules so they can live as civilized people. So, Kant is expressing sort of a certain version of that, an iteration of that, rather than saying, well, people would beat each other's throats in a state of war against war, Kant, at least in the passage that you read, is described as saying that people have potential, unique human potential, but it can't be realized by individuals alone, and not even in their own lifetimes. So the only way for human potential to be realized is to form alliances and to form communities and states, and only over generations would those states evolve toward, I think you talked about republics and alliances between republics, which would lead people away from war, federations lead people away from war because the citizens wouldn't want to finance those wars. They'd rather use their resources for improving their lives. So it's a type of social contract.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider that these social theorists see, especially, I'm not sure if Kant did kind of accept Hobbes's premise that the natural state of humans is that of kind of where everyone's at war with everyone else. Maybe I'm trying to think if it's how to describe this. Maybe a more temperate view would be that without social contracts, there is a potential for war. Because if groups don't know each other, if they have no mechanism for understanding or resolving disagreements, the possibility of violence is a lot greater than if they do have a mechanism that can control the possibility of violence. That's actually very interesting to think about how we see human nature, how human beings are limited as individuals, might actually be the key to determining how a theorist creates their ideas of progress. Because essentially, it's by defining what they believe is limiting on the individual that they can create an idea of what a better society would be, because it would be less limiting on an individual in specific ways, whether that is reducing wars and creating eras of peace, or creating scientific progress. I do think it would be interesting to stop for a bit on the idea of a priori knowledge. But before I do that, I want to break for a quick halfway point moment. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in. You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find archives of our show on tcps.podbean.com. This has been a show with your host, Aaron Wang, and my co-host, Michael Robert Kaditz, on the idea of progress in the Enlightenment from the historical and societal perspective. And we're adding some ethics in on the side as they're relevant to the discussion.
It's interesting how Hobbes expresses his social contract theory in the negative, whereas Kant does it in the positive, at least according to the reading that you just brought to us, Aaron. So Hobbes talks about the horrible way that people would behave in a state of nature, and no civilized person, no rational person would want to live in that terrible way, the state of war of all against all. Whereas Kant talks about human potential, the potential for humans realizing great things.